There are many different ways to communicate the science of volcanoes and other geohazards. Might be through social media, workshops, public events, and some ways that you may not even expect. It's also just as important for us to train and support other scientists to become better science communicators themselves. So I'm very excited today to be joined for this episode of Volcanology by two fantastic geoscientists and geoscience communicators, Dr. Wendy Bowen and Beth Bartel. Hello to you both.
Hello. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for joining me today on this. I'm really, really excited. Just about anything we could talk about. I've got a list of things potentially we could go into, but we will see what comes about. So what I'd love to hear, first of all, is a bit of background about both of you, how you've got into geoscience and where you are now, literally, in the world. So I think, Beth, we'll start with you.
Oh, I was going to throw it to Wendy. My usual trick. And Wendy, we'll start. How did I get into geoscience? Adventure, the same way a lot of people get into geoscience, which is not the only way to get into geoscience, but just really fascinated by the outdoors. And then when I went to college, I wanted to do environmental studies because I wanted to have an impact, a positive impact on our planet and society and how the two coincide. And I just got sold on geology, partly because every class had an associated field trip, and that sounded really fun. And it was really fun. And from there, I got really interested in natural hazards. My long story short is that I ended up going on for a master's in geophysics. I wouldn't put me in the geophysics box, but I did Wendy can attest to that. But I had the opportunity to work on a project on using GPS on active volcanoes in the Philippines. I was like, well, that sounds pretty darn cool. So sign me up for that. And then followed GPS as a tool rather than volcanoes as a thing. I was a field engineer, got to work on a lot of cool stuff, including a bunch of volcanoes, met a lot of cool scientists, including volcanologists, and decided that a really great way for me to make an impact was to use what I thought were my greatest or strongest talents, which were in communication. So I went back to school for master's in journalism and then went back to where I was working before, a place called UNAVCO, to be their science communication and outreach specialist. And that is where I met Wendy, and we started collaborating because we were in sister roles at sister organizations and then became work wives. And yeah, we're basically best friends and basically do everything together when we can.
Fantastic. And so where are you joining us in the world today?
Oh yeah. So then I decided to, yeah, really get deeper into my passions, go back for a PhD. I'm 45 years old. So if for those of you, I see this on Twitter sometimes, I'm 31. Am I too old to go back for a PhD? No, you're not. I'm 45. I went back to school last year and I am in Guatemala right now. And I am putting all my interests together into one glorious PhD, mainly focused on social science. So social dimensions of natural hazards. And I'm working on a volcano called Fuego here, which is amazingly frequently active, which is why I just looked out my window. So you can pretend you're seeing Fuego, which I'm not. I'm seeing a tree, but I know it's out there. I don't even know if I looked in the right direction, honestly. I have a horrible sense of direction, but like, it's outside. GPS. GPS, so you know. That's it. I'm great with maps and GPS. Just, you know, tools. That's why we have tools.
Fantastic. Okay, so now it's over to you, Wendy.
All right. Well, after Beth, I feel like my story is a little bit wah-wah. But I did not start off interested really in science at all. I always identified as an artist. And so I actually went to college as a theater major. Shakespearean acting is kind of my jam. And then I moved to Los Angeles to follow a career in theater. And I did that for a while. And then something happened, the Hector Mine earthquake. So it was a magnitude 7.1 that was out in the desert. And I grew up on the East Coast. I had never really felt an earthquake, some little tiny ones, but it was an experience. And I was like, that is amazing. And I want to be involved with that. So I went and asked to volunteer at the USGS in Pasadena. And they said no, because they're very busy after a large urban earthquake is felt, right? Some I went back, though, and I said, really, I really am interested in this. I'd really like to help. And they gave me a chance. Here I am, an actor. I had taken some geology classes, had a, you know, geology minor, but not like a real geologist or anything, to my mind. And so they let me volunteer, and eventually they hired me because they were like, wow, this whole, like, being able to talk to people and explain to them why this is important. Like, this is really critical, and we want to help invest in that. So I worked for them for a while, decided that geologic hazards, in particular for me, earthquake hazards, was a place where I could be really impactful. And like Beth, it was a place where I could use my different skill sets. And so I went back, I got a master's degree at Ohio State, and then I went and got a PhD at Arizona State, did postdoc and all that other stuff. And then I decided that, you know, the academy wasn't exactly for me. I didn't have a driving urge to be a professor, and I was lucky enough to get hired at the Incorporated Research Institutions for Seismology, or IRIS, which is the sister organization to UNAVCO. And I was hired in as the science communication specialist, or the outreach specialist. So I was in the complementary role to Beth. So that's how we met. We worked together. I am still there. Now I'm the senior science communication specialist. And, you know, it's awesome. I'm really interested in working on rapid onset geologic hazards. So the way we deal with earthquakes, talk about earthquakes, think about earthquakes can be very similar to the way we think about other hazards like volcanoes. So there's a lot of overlap between volcanology and earthquake science.
Yeah. And also for just how you communicate it with other scientists and other people as well. All of these things are completely translatable across every aspect of earth science, ocean science, meteorological science. So for what both of you do, you work in these organizations which help train the public and also train other scientists, that you've done in that time. Do you find that it's very easy to talk to people across all ranges of science, even though, you know, you've got your own specific areas?
Yeah, I mean, yes. One of the things that we try and train people to do is get past the jargon, because jargon serves a really important purpose to your little community. You know, it allows you to communicate very complex ideas quickly and very accurately. But when you move outside of your tiny little niche, it can be a real stumbling block for communicating. And so even between earthquake hazard scientists, or even within geoscience, we try and get people to not talk using jargon. And that breaks down so many barriers. And so a lot of the issues that we are dealing with are very similar. The time frames and the time scales that we're dealing with can be very similar. And so there's so much more common ground that we can find than there is difference. So I think we can talk to people. And scientists in a lot of ways are all very similar. We have similar goals. We have similar passion for our jobs in most cases, because we're not here for the money, you know?
True. I mean, one thing we like to talk about is, you know, imagine being at a big meeting like AGU, the American Geophysical Union, which is approximately ginormous, right? Like over 20,000 people in a non-pandemic year. Should that ever happen again? And, you know, just think of going from one room to the next in the oral sessions, and whether you're likely to understand the session next door to whatever session you're going to. So even within geosciences, there's so much diversity that we have to be able to speak to other scientists as though we're speaking to the public. So, I mean, really, I'm a huge proponent of learning public communication skills for just better communication in general. And then we can talk to all other humans, including other scientists, because really, if we're speaking our science, I'm doing air quotes here, our science, we're speaking to such a narrow group of people that, right, really becomes obvious when we go somewhere like AGU. We're like, I just don't even understand the language this person used in the room two doors down from where I'm presenting in an hour.
And it's super important, I think, when you work in the fields that we work in. I mean, I feel, and I think you feel too, Beth, like we have a social responsibility to communicate our science in a way that maybe, you know, other sciences don't necessarily have. It's really important to study, you know, quasars and black holes, but there's not the immediacy to people's lives that geohazards and geoscience has in a lot of cases. And so I think developing science communication skills among geoscientists, especially hazard scientists, is really, really critical, because the work that we do impacts real people's lives every day. And so it's important to be able to talk about it.
Yeah, and I'll just quickly add that I admit it. There's a lot of science that I'm not particularly interested in. So to put me in, you know, even a science category, like, oh, you love science. Well, I mean, I love things about it. You know, I love the stuff that I love. So I think for me, that's a lesson in science communication. I mean, it's a lesson in making assumptions about people, for one thing, because, you know, I'm not a science fiction person. That offends a lot of scientists I know. I saw Sam, your eyes just rolled. What do you mean? How can you not like science fiction? Yeah. But I think that we always have to sell our science. And I'm reluctant to use the word sell because it sounds, you know, it sounds bad. It sounds manipulative. But I think we can't assume that somebody else is going to be interested in our science or interested in the same thing we're interested in. So, you know, while a scientist in the same field pretty much has to read our papers if they're relevant, nobody else does. Like, the public doesn't have to stay and listen to our talk or read an article that we wrote. So when we're talking to anybody outside our media audience, you know, we have to share what's exciting about it. So anybody can make me excited about their science if they present it well. So it's, you know, we just have to not make the assumption that what I'm doing is inherently interesting. Like, it's interesting to you. So share with me what makes it interesting to you, and then I'll be excited about it too.
Yeah, exactly on that point. I remember, so I met both of you at these AGU workshops in the Sharing Science program, which, if anybody's curious about it, check out the AGU Sharing Science platform, because there's a ton of fantastic resources on there about how to communicate your science better and all of these little kind of things, you know, preparing your elevator pitch for your subject to get someone who's in a completely different field of academia or just society altogether. But one of the ones that really sticks in my mind is a workshop you did, Beth. I think it was at the IFC conference in 2017. And there was an exercise where you got people to, you'll probably correct me on this, but you had two people, say, facing each other, and one person had to draw something that was given to them. It was the simplest exercise. One was, you know, there'd be a square box, then a squiggly line, and then a slightly, you know, flattened circle that were all spaced in some particular way. My picture was covered, and I had to describe to the other person what was in front of me. And it seemed like such a simple exercise, you know, describing shapes to a person. But at the end, I remember just looking around and people realizing that, no, these are the basics of communication. The instructions you give and how you tell people to perceive something that they aren't familiar with or that they can't see. And I thought it was just a fantastic way to introduce people to that very basic fundamental communication concept.
Yeah, and that's one that Wendy and I have led together a lot since then, too. And I can't take credit for it. I wish I could. It's an exercise that was developed by, or at least distributed by, Portal to the Public, which was a National Science Foundation-funded program for interactive science museums to train scientists to be better communicators within the museum space. And it's they have such good lessons for all of us as communicators. And when I first did that exercise, I described one of the shapes as a salt diapir. And right, that's pretty specific, but I was like, well, I think it's general enough. And of course, I was already working in my job as a science communication specialist, taking the trainer's workshop. And I was like, you know, I'm going to ace, because I'm also competitive. You know, I'm going to ace this. I'm going to do a great job of it. I'm going to be amazing. I'm going to show them all how it's done, because we all have some ego, right? And yeah, and so I described one of the shapes as a salt diapir, thinking that was somehow a normal thing. And my boss was in my group. My boss was in my group, and she just looked at me. And I was like, oh, atmospheric scientists. I guess atmospheric scientists don't talk about salt diapirs. Let that be a lesson to me. And that was a lesson to me, both communication and in a little bit of pride there. So it is. It's such a great exercise just to think about what we take for granted. Some people have described one of the shapes as a golf flag, and other people in the group, especially, you know, people maybe from other countries or different demographics, like, I don't know what a golf flag looks like. So, you know, there are all these pieces of language we take for granted that could have to do either with like culture and class and ethnicity and all these parts of our identity that we don't think about, that we take for granted, and that can make us not only not understandable, but also not inclusive to people within sciences.
Yeah, and when it comes down to that kind of basics as well, do you find that your approach to teaching the public about science actually becomes very similar to teaching other scientists how to communicate that science? Because you're almost trying to bring the scientists to that level so that it's perceivable to the entire public. I guess that goes out to both of you.
With scientists, what I find is that we're often making them unlearn skills that they learned during the process of becoming a scientist in graduate school or wherever, because the way that we teach students to write, scientific writing is actually like antithetical to good communication to a public audience, right? You want to start your communication with why something matters. Why should people care? And then you go into what exactly you're doing and finally the details. But if you think about how scientists put together a paper or how they put together a talk, a lot of it is focused on the uncertainties, not what we do know. A lot of it is focused on the data and the methodology, which is very important for the scientific process, not so much for the result, which is what the public is interested in. So it really is just a matter of perspective and in some cases getting people to flip the script. But in the end, when you want, especially now that we're pushing so hard and rightly for a lot of cross-disciplinary research, you have to get people talking to each other in understandable ways. And so we want scientists to start talking to each other in some ways exactly like they would the public, because scientists are just people. And if you're talking to a scientist in another field, they are essentially the public to you. And so if we can just kind of reframe things for people and reframe these conversations and kind of teach people to unlearn these shorthand bad habits that we have, I think that'll go a long way towards allowing us to understand each other and work together more effectively.
Absolutely. But one of the key components of that, of course, is the use of social media in science, which is that place where we can break down those barriers between the scientists and the public. And I think, you know, even within our own Twitter spheres or wherever we live to exist, sometimes it can be a lot of the same voices that we hear and that we receive information from. So sometimes it really takes us pushing out of that circle and also onto other platforms to actually achieve that.
I think we're as guilty as anyone else of you know, preaching to the choir and assuming everyone thinks like us or should think like us. And so, yeah, I mean, one of the big skills that we try to teach is listening. I think it's the most important communication skill is how to listen. And part of listening is starting with the assumption that not everyone thinks like me. And so I think that's, you know, when you give those echo chambers, that can really reinforce the idea that everyone thinks like me and everyone should think like me. And in some cases, I think that's true, that everyone should think like me. But you know, we also need to get, you know, out of those spaces and challenge ourselves and be introspective about ourselves as well and the way we approach science.
No, I was just going to say, you know, it's also about who you want to talk to. So depending on the demographic that you're interested in communicating with, you've got to be on different social media platforms because you have to meet people where they are. You have to meet people where they are physically, whether that's, you know, in a classroom or on social media. You have to meet people where they are intellectually. And as scientists, we have to meet people where they are emotionally. You know, we have to take the emotion, the passion that we have and the reason that our science matters. And we have to give that to people in a way that they can actually relate to. And what are some of the things that we can all relate on? You know, we all have these emotional centers. And if we can relate to each other in that way, then we can always find common ground.
Absolutely. And as you say, doing that almost, we have to push ourselves outside of our comfort zone, like you said, to other platforms. And Wendy, I'm going to give you as the example here to the world of TikTok, which I looked at it and thought, you know what, I'm not even going to attempt to do this. But then as more and more time went on through like 2020 and 2021, there's that realization of there's a new platform out there. It's growing, it's getting bigger and bigger, and there's a completely different demographic. And the previous platforms that we're using, they're still in use, but not by the same people. And who are we looking to talk to now? It's a newer, younger generation that are in a different platform that operates in a completely different way.
Yeah, I think we have to use what tools come to our hand. You know, just like Beth uses GPS to study volcanoes, and that's how we get back to that. And that's taken her all over the world. You know, social media has taken us in all of these different directions, and TikTok is just another tool that we have. So you've been doing an excellent job integrating into the TikTok world.
Every day I'm finding another scientist or geoscientist, even just, you know, people who are finding rocks on the ground and opening them up and showing people for videos. And if it happens to be, you know, a moment that goes viral, it's like, fantastic. 8 million people somewhere have seen a video of someone cracking open a rock and there's fossils inside. Brilliant.
Oh, yeah. Agree. And then on the other, the opposite end of numbers, so social media, digital media gives us these numbers. And the opposite side of that maybe is when we want to get out of our circles, you know, sometimes doing so on small scales, in person, one-on-one or small groups can be really impactful. And that's a way to reach a very different demographic than who's on TikTok, and a demographic that's still voting, for example. And shout out to one of our heroes of this, Karen Kirk, who Wendy and I both absolutely love working with. So Karen Kirk at KRRK, look her up. She is the master of having conversations about climate change and environment and how that weighs in on politics. And she has, like, as a scientist, she's been very scientific about how she's approached communication and learned lessons from trying over and over and over again different conversation styles and how to communicate with people, and has a great article about canvassing during the last election cycle, going door to door, talking to people. She is the queen of the common ground conversation and exploring that. So if anyone out there is interested in learning more about that, how to have these hard conversations, contentious conversations, find common ground, look up Karen Kirk. She is also a fantastic writer and presenter. So anything you watch or read of hers is going to be well worth the time.
Yeah, finding points of connection is always so important. Like Sam and I have a point of connection. Our birthdays are on the same day. We know that because we both care about volcanoes, and it was on the day that Mount St. Helens erupted. So,
oh my gosh, that must be May 18th.
Well, personally, I really hate that because I was old enough to remember that eruption and it ruined my birthday. But I think Sammy may be a little younger and you did not get a ruined birthday party, which means maybe you love Mount St. Helens a little bit more.
It's still a bit of stealing thunder, but it's a really great point for you to mention that, you know, the impact versus the number. And even just that one-on-one conversation with someone can be just as impactful as a moment that goes big through social media or other media forums. One of the best pieces of advice I was ever that I've taken away for me in science communication, in terms of, you know, how to get through to someone or just not change their mind, but to, you know, make them see what's right, is to validate the truth in what they know. And someone said those exact words to me once, and it just basically blew my conception of this, how you can get through to someone. It's that everybody knows something. There's always some basis of fact. Sometimes it's buried very, very deep, but there's always some foundation of truth or scientific evidence in there. And if you can find that and validate that for that person, then it just makes that connection so much easier rather than trying to argue immediately against what they're saying.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And for people who are out there in the improv world, theatrical improv, yes. And is like the big term from theater. And the more we can say yes to people rather than no, the more open we are in our conversations. We take people off the defensive, including ourselves, and we can be more open. And that doesn't mean agreeing with someone when you think they're wrong, but agreeing where we can and then taking the conversation from there. Like, yes, I agree with what you said about this point, and I want to add this other point. Yeah, can be really helpful. And one of the things I like to say in communication trainings as well is, especially if it's communicating with the public, is if somebody walks away from an interaction, if it's an in-person interaction, and they don't remember the science, they don't remember the science story, haven't changed their mind, but they walk away with a good feeling about it and think, I just met a scientist and they were cool. Like, I feel like, you know, that's where we want the bar. Anything over that is a bonus. But if somebody walks away from an interaction thinking, I just had a positive interaction, and takes that positive feeling about a real life scientist and science, then that's a win.
Absolutely. So what you're saying also as well is that we need more improv workshops at science conferences.
No. Yeah.
Wendy, you up?
Of course. I'm on it. Let's do it.
The funny thing is, Wendy and I have agreed that we're not, as much as we like to improv in our workshops, improv isn't really our, it's not really our thing. We like scripts, but improv is really good, like, for us too. You know, it's good for us to push us out of our comfort zones and get more comfortable with the unexpected, which is what science is all about, right?
Yeah, well, the next conference we're all at together, I'll throw some improv exercises.
Yes.
It is all absolutely.
All right. We're here for it.
And so another completely different way that, you know, using different mediums and visuals to communicate bits of science. Both of you also did some geoscience yoga recently over the past year. What is it? There's earthquake yoga, volcano yoga, and I think there was a glacier yoga as well.
Yeah. I think you've hit them all. I have to shout out here to Sonia Melander, who is a fantastic volcanologist working at, she was at Mount St. Helens Institute when I met her coming back to Mount St. Helens. It was at a 5-day field camp for middle school girls, which is pretty amazing. And I enabled my way into it. And over late night session of trying to put together an exercise, we came up with this idea of volcano yoga. And then the three of us had to, we were pushed into making a video about it. And then Wendy and I ran with that and had to do some more because it was so, so fun.
Well, you know, it's good for so many reasons, particularly if you think about the educational space with littler kids. Our bigger kids doesn't really matter, I guess. But when you can, the more senses that you can involve, the more likely they are to remember something. So if we can get them up and moving in the classroom, if we can make this exciting and interesting to them, it's something they're more likely to remember. Plus, it's nice to just have a break, a reason to get up out of your chair, get the blood flowing. And it's, I don't know, it's another fun way to deliver science and information. And so, yeah, we were like, volcano yoga was great. Let's do all the yoga. So don't worry, there'll be more coming. We just have to both be in the same country for a little while.
And it's the perfect combination of like moving your body, silliness and nerdiness all in the same thing.
Yeah. As you say, particularly for young education, it's shaped so much of earth science is so visual in dynamic and static ways that for 2, 3, 4 year olds just starting to learn about some of these concepts, make the shape of a volcano, what does a P wave do? What does an S wave do? Lie on the ground and be a meandering river.
Like that. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like you're well on your way to maybe the next video is going to be three of us, Sam.
Mm-hmm. We're going to rope you in. We're going to be doing the migration of river systems or something. We can all be sinuous and then we can, you know, it's all sorts of things we can do.
Forget CrossFit, forget calisthenics. It's time for geo yoga and geo fits.
Well, hey, people are already doing things like dance your thesis, you know, dance your PhD topic, dance your paper. So I can, you know, it's catching on. It's fun. It's silly. It's interesting. And it's a new way to communicate things that are really fun. Like, I remember when I see people that dance their PhD and I see them later and I'm like, I know them. They study this thing. Does anybody remember me from my poster?
Probably not.
So more open mics and open dance sessions at the next meeting then, as well as improv workshops and yoga.
Absolutely. I think the more things that we can do, the better, right? Because some people are comfortable in different environments. Some people are going to shine in other ways. Like, let people do the thing that makes them happy and comfortable. And for some people, that's going to be giving talks behind a podium. For other people, that's going to be doing TikTok videos. The more ways that we can allow on-ramps to our science, the more people that we can engage and educate.
And one of the things that we also really like about science communication is the way it can, training specifically, is that is how it can bond us. So there's an EOS piece about this that we wrote with our colleague Maite Agopian, and we talk about the side benefits of science communication training that, hopefully we all become better communicators to the public through it, but we also become better communicators to each other, and we bond and become hopefully more comfortable in our own skin, because as you saw, Sam, like what we like to do is really interactive and hopefully fun. And when we're getting out of our comfort zone, which a lot of us are when we're communicating, we try to create that safe, fun space where we can be our full selves. And we both think that's really important, to be able to bring our full selves to science. So within the science community, we try to form those bonds as well that we can form when we're talking about communication. Because when we're talking about communication, we have to talk about things like emotions that we don't usually talk about when we're doing science, right? We don't talk about those in our quaternary geology class or our volcanology class or geophysics class. So to have a space where we can talk about the importance of emotion can be really powerful for the people in the room.
Yeah. And just on a personal level as well, I know my time in science has been completely enriched and changed, always for the good, by the people I've met outside of my field and specific research interests. Absolutely. Hands down, it's one of my most memorable and favorite parts of doing this job. It's the people I meet outside of the work that I do.
Absolutely. I have a quick story about that, if that's okay. So for my PhD, I worked in India in the Himalayas. And so part of my field area was K2, so second tallest mountain in the world. It was incredibly steep and treacherous terrain, and it was in a geographically kind of fraught area. So right on the border between India, Pakistan, and China, who are not terribly friendly countries. So there were a lot of places that I couldn't access, but it's difficult to do regional geology when you can't access large swaths of the area you're studying. And so I'm sitting around in grad school with my roommates and, you know, some other people outside of my research group, and lamenting the fact that I can't go to these places and how am I supposed to make this map? And one of them goes, well, I mean, we map geology on Mars. I mean, there's a satellite circling Earth that does the same thing. You could use that. Like, what? I had no idea. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And he's like, yeah, the Aster satellite. You can figure out using these different spectra, you know, the spectra of the minerals, which tells you about the rocks. And so you can make some assumptions and quapa, geologic map. And I was like, okay. But if I hadn't gone outside my discipline, if I hadn't been talking to people outside of kind of my normal everyday topic, I never would have known that was a possibility. I never would have known that was a tool that I could use. And so it only makes us stronger. It only makes us better scientists to branch out, get outside of our small sliver of focus, get outside of our study area and meet more people. So that's my little story about why it's important to talk to others.
Because you can end up driving a chapter of your thesis.
And then speaking of books as well, both of you are going to actually be featured in a book coming out soon.
Yay!
So this is, let me get this right. So this is Quake Chasers, 15 Women Rocking Earthquake Science, Women of Power.
Yes, that's it. It's going to be really, really cool. So by the time this podcast launches, I think it'll be available from probably the big booksellers, but make sure that you go to your local bookseller and support them.
And the people in it are amazing. The author was really fun to work with. And, you know, it's a small enough world that we're friends with a lot of people who are featured. And I'm super excited. We haven't seen it yet. So I'm super excited to be able to read the chapters about all my buddies and hear these backstories, because everybody has a different story coming into, you know, what we're doing. And that's another thing we like to tell people who are, you know, maybe undergrads or younger, like, you know, this isn't necessarily an end point for us where this is my job, this is my life, and this is how I will be in static mode for the next 10, 20, 30 years. Like, no, I'm going to finish my PhD and do something next. I was in my last job for 6 years. I did something before that. I did something after that. There are some jobs that have more of a linear trajectory. But there are a lot of different pathways out there as your listeners are hearing, because you talk about that at the beginning of each episode. So I guess, you know, what I want to say to all those folks out there who are on the younger side and maybe double majors, like both Wendy and I were, like, you don't know exactly what you want to do because you like a lot of things. Yep. That's fine. It's okay to not know what's coming next and to want to do a lot of different things. It'll be fine. Try to put those interests together. And I don't remember where I came from or where I was going with that, but there we go. Let that be a lesson to you.
I have a teenage daughter. She's getting ready. You know, she's starting to look at colleges. And this is what I tell her all the time. You know, you have broad interests. Make sure that you go to a place that has a lot of different things that fall outside of that, because the job that you may love, you probably don't even know exists yet. Keep yourself open. Follow the things that bring you joy, things that you're passionate about. Learn everything you can, because all of those are tools that you can use. You know, no experience is ever wasted. So don't feel bad if you don't know what you want to do if you're 15 or 25 or 35 or 45. Like, that's okay. And you can change midstream. I was an actress. Now I'm a scientist. Who knows what I'm going to be next time you talk to me?
Yes, exactly. Yep. If you can find ways to bring together your different passions into, as you say, it might be a job that doesn't exist because it's there for you to create. So that's absolutely brilliant. So what we'll just wrap up with now, Wendy, you kind of mentioned one, but if you've got a nice, short, snappy, you know, memorable volcanic or geohazard related experience, something that you've done in your life that just always sticks in your memory, it'd be great to hear something.
I love you. Okay. So yeah, I did. I thought about this a little bit. So many, of course, to choose from. People who know me well know that my master's work in the Philippines was really formative for me. So I chose this story from the Philippines. It is a non-eruptive volcanic hazard. So once upon a time, when I was working as a master's student with colleagues at the Philippine Institute of Volcanology and Seismology, PhVolcs, the group there responsible for monitoring their volcanoes, they graciously invited me to go with them up to the crater, the caldera of Pinatubo volcano, which is a huge volcano in the Philippines, to install some lake gauge instrumentation. Whole big story here that I won't go into, but suffice to say that we made it up. They said, you know, I was like, I know they're Lahar hazards. They're like, yeah, nope, we won't go if the weather's bad. Okay, well, we get there and start the hike. It starts raining. And I'm like, so rain's not bad weather? And they're like, oh, it's light rain. It's fine. Okay. So, you know, we hike up, and long story short, flash flood comes down after we come up, but before our gear comes up. And so we spent the night up on the caldera rim with a bunch of military and journalists and porters and us, but without our gear. So this story is called No More Lonely Nights, which is one of the songs that we like to sing on karaoke. Anybody who knows anything about the Philippines knows it. Huge on karaoke. So we were actually on a 4x6 foot tarp. It was, I think there were 9 of us. I think it was me and 9 men from PhVolcs. And we had a tarp strung overhead that was dripping, and we were sitting on life vests, and that's how we spent the night. And all night, periodically, I could hear landslides, like rock falls coming down from around the caldera rim. And I was not scared at all, because I'm tough of nails. No, I was terrified, because that's a natural human reaction, to be scared of things. And it was dark, and I couldn't see actually what was happening. I could just hear these landslides. And I also didn't understand most of the communication, because I was the only foreigner up there and everybody else spoke Tagalog. So I couldn't understand the conversation. So when I would ask about things, you know, I would get some abbreviated form of what they had discussed or not. So I had no idea what their risk perception was. And I asked, you know, are those landslides? You know, where are those landslides? Oh, don't worry about it. It's on the other side of the caldera. And then, you know, 5 minutes later, there was one that sounds like it was, you know, 100 meters away. So in the morning, I could see that those landslides were coming down only in gullies, whereas I was imagining this whole ledge we were on was going to go down into the caldera lake at some point. Nope, they were happening in the gullies. And I thought, okay, well, you know, if I'd known that, that would have been really helpful for me to know. And that story, at the time, I didn't think of it in a risk perception frame, but now that I'm studying risk and communication and our perception of hazards, that story definitely comes back to me. And that idea of just not having that information and understanding. And when we're talking about hazards, we really need to understand the hazards scientifically and and know that. And there is, you know, as Wendy's learned a lot through her work with earthquakes, there's just great, I guess, comfort in understanding, because that enables us to make informed decisions. So it doesn't mean always like, oh no, the hazard's not that big of a deal. Maybe it is a big deal, but if I understand the hazard and the process behind it, I can make more informed decisions for myself.
I was going to tell the story about the little ground squirrels in Argentina and how they scared me to death. And we all slept in tents together for several days because we didn't know I was making that noise. But I'm not. Like, all of my exciting snowbird stories have to do with animals, like seeing snow leopards or, you know, like getting a cat from Bolivia. But that's not what I'm going to talk about. And it's not even a fieldwork story, but it's about risk perception. So I'm on Twitter and I talk to a lot of people and I have a lot of people DM me that are afraid of earthquakes. And I had a young man DM me. He lived in San Diego and they had been having kind of a swarm of earthquakes. There had been a moderate size event and then lots of little ones, but he was feeling all of them because he lived very close to where they were occurring and he was terrified. I mean, he was terrified. And so we spent several days going back and forth and I would send him resources and he would read them and digest them. And then he would come back and he had all of these questions. And then I didn't hear from him for a little while. And then I got a note on Twitter from his account from his mom. And she was saying that he had started sleeping through the night again. And she wanted to thank me because he felt in control of the situation again. They had gone out and made an earthquake kit. They had moved his room around so that he felt safer in that space. And now he was no longer afraid and he was sleeping through the night. So that to me is one of those stories that when I'm having a really terrible day or I'm like, thinking about how like it's so stupid that I'm just doing meetings and emails, I'm making no impact in the world. Little things matter, you know, taking the time to talk to people about things like this, it makes a difference. And so that's going to be my story now.
Absolutely fantastic. As you say, the one-on-one interaction and the impact that that can have on just one person's life.
Just knowing, you know, what we imagine is almost always worse than the reality.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Royce, for sharing but two very, very different, but I say equally important stories in just the importance of communication and how communication and perception, how we communicate science with others, to ourselves, and between each other.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. But anything that we've talked about today, we'll put in the links for the description so you can follow the work that both Wendy and Beth have been doing. Beth, I hope the rest of your field work goes well in Guatemala, and there are plenty more cats for you to enjoy.
Thank you. I will keep posting pictures on Twitter of all the lovely cats I find.
Yep. Well, thank you both for joining us today. And I hope you've enjoyed this episode and I hope you'll join us for another one.